Hello, this is Kenny Williamson, and welcome back to another episode of McKill's Deck Chronicles. In this episode, we're going to continue on with our series of Dr. Kent Hovind. This series is called The Hovind Theory, and I think you're going to find it very interesting. I know I personally did. So we're going to continue on. We're going to do the second installment of Dr. Kent Hovind's seminar. So, you know, give us an email. Let us know what you think, if you like it or not. And also wanted to throw out there, I have completed a book that I wrote called The Haunting of Virginia Krim. And this is a true story about my mother growing up as a child and being tormented by demons and demonic activity. So if that is something you are interested in reading about, you can get that book on either Amazon or on Barnes & Noble. So let's get on to Kent Hovind's seminar, part two.
There are very few trees in the world that are 300 feet tall. How do you get a tree 300 feet tall standing up under 1,000 feet of permanently frozen ground? What happened? I'm going to give you what I call the Hovind theory of what caused all these phenomena, but I need to review a little science for you. Many people have been influential in developing this in my brain anyway. I appreciate Walt Brown and Henry Morris and Baumgartner and some of these guys that have done work, and the biblical flood and the ice epoch had a great influence on me. But ultimately, I have to take the blame for this if it's wrong. I'm going to teach you a few things about science and then give you the Hovind theory. The inverse square law tells us if two objects are attracted to each other, like the Earth and the Moon, the force of attraction is inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. In English, that means if you half the distance, or if you brought the Moon into one-third the distance, you take the one-third, flip it over, and square it. It's now 9 times the gravitational pull. Inverse square laws apply when you're dealing with forces involving gravity, light, magnetism, and girls. I travel every single week. I believe I've been home 8 Sundays in 14 years. I flew 215 times last year, was gone 210 days away from home. So I get to come home every week. When I get a certain distance from my wife, it's, "Hello, dear, how are you doing?" When you half the distance, it is 4 times the attraction, not 2, 4 times the attraction. When you half the distance again, it is too late. So guys, the secret is stay about 10 feet away and you won't have a problem, okay? Now, the inverse square law is one thing to learn. The second thing you need to learn is a spinning top, any spinning object, behaves in a peculiar way if it is struck by something. If you throw a rock at a spinning top, it'll wobble around for a while, or you can do it with a gyroscope, and it'll wobble around, and then it'll recover spinning smoothly, usually at some new crazy angle. You can actually determine when it was struck if you could see a graph of a wavy line of how it behaved as it was wobbling. Interesting. The Earth has no doubt wobbled through the years. The North Pole has moved around. Today, the Earth is tilted over 23.5 degrees, which is why they always mount the globe on that 23.5 degree angle. Stonehenge is an interesting stone building. Apparently, it was built to worship the sun at summer solstice. But today, Stonehenge does not line up. The Temple Amun-Ra was also apparently built to worship the sun at summer solstice, the longest day of the year, but it doesn't line up. Edexis, same thing. The Earth is tilted over today, and that's what causes the seasons. Usually on June 21st, occasionally on June 20th, but usually June 21st, it's the longest day of the year. Because the Earth is tilted, in our case with the northern hemisphere, we're tilted toward the sun. So we get more sunlight, and the North Pole gets pure sunlight all the time, 24 hours. George Dodwell, the famous Australian astronomer, did a lot of study of the shadows, of the solstice shadows recorded by ancient astronomers. He said, "You know, it looks to me like something struck the Earth." When he followed the wavy line made of the solstice shadows, he said something struck the Earth about 4,350 years ago and caused the Earth to wobble for several thousand years. Today, the Earth is pretty stable. The Earth's North Pole doesn't move around very much. But could it be that something actually struck planet Earth about the time of Noah's flood? Now, that's what the scientific evidence points toward. Interesting. Today, the Earth is tilted over, and that's what causes the seasons. The first mention of cold weather in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 8, after the flood. I doubt they had huge polar ice caps before the flood came. I flew up as far as we could fly in Canada and then drove 2 hours north of that, way up into central Saskatchewan. We were only right about here. There's a whole lot of earth above us, but they said this is about the limit of habitable land where you can actually do farming, because north of here, the seasons are too harsh. You can't do any farming. There is a huge chunk of planet Earth, north and south, near the poles, that is simply unusable for farmland. Now, the Bible says God formed the world to be inhabited. I don't think what we have today is anything similar to what Adam and Eve saw. Next thing you need to keep in mind, the moon has craters on it. But we never see the moon get struck by anything. Where did these craters come from on the moon? Even Mercury has craters on it. Where did these craters come from? Mars has a canyon much larger than Grand Canyon. When the scientists studied this canyon on Mars, they said, wow, this canyon formed in a matter of weeks. Because they say there was melting water in one of the craters, it overflowed the rim and washed out this canyon very, very quickly. Well, duh. Why can they see a canyon on Mars where we can't find any water for sure and say this thing formed quickly, and you can look at Grand Canyon on planet Earth and can't conclude that water formed that canyon very quickly? I don't understand the stupidity involved here. Looks to me like you ought to be able to see that. As a ridge at the edge of the crater gave way and this canyon formed in a matter of months, certainly less than a year, said one of the scientists. Next thing to keep in mind, it's called the Meissner effect. How many have ever seen two magnets? You put them together and the one will float on top of the other one. You know what I'm talking about here? It's called the Meissner effect. That's how the Japanese trains go. We rode on one of those trains when I was in Japan. Man, they go flying down the tracks with magnetic levitation. No resistance that way, no friction. Next thing to keep in mind, there are comets flying around through space, and these comets are extremely cold, 300 to 400 below zero Fahrenheit. Don't lick it. I need to find out if any of you are or were as dumb as I was as a kid. How many of you have a piece of your tongue stuck to a pump handle or a flagpole someplace on planet Earth right now because you licked it when it was cold? Come on now, be honest. Put your hand up. Okay, there's several. All right. Don't lick something 300 below zero. Trust me on that one. Okay, that'll be the last thing you lick for a while. If you throw a snowball too fast, it'll break apart. You couldn't possibly shoot a snowball out of a cannon. If you did, it would simply break apart in pieces before it even got out the end of the barrel. So a super cold ice meteor, if it were coming toward the Earth, would build up speed because of the inverse square law. As it got going faster and faster, it would break up out in space into a bazillion little ice crystals. Those would then shower down on the Earth as super cold snow. Next thing you need to keep in mind, the Earth has a very strong magnetic field, but it's getting weaker. At the time of the flood, it was probably about 15 to 20 times stronger than it is today. The magnetic field is weakening. The magnetic field would deflect super cold ice crystals to the poles, most of them. Also, super cold ice is easily statically charged. The northern lights are caused because of the Earth's magnetic field. How many have ever seen the northern lights? Unbelievably gorgeous. If you've never seen them, it's worth just get up there. So I've seen them in South Dakota and up in Canada. Unbelievably beautiful. The northern lights are something to worth seeing. Anyway, the pre-flood world was very different. The world probably had a canopy of ice or water above the atmosphere. We cover that on video 2. Now, there are some creationists, including Walt Brown, who disagree. They say there was no canopy. And I think the arguments they use can be easily answered. And I'd be glad to discuss that if you'd like more. Next thing to keep in mind, who on earth was Peleg? Genesis chapter 10, and I hate to say this about the Bible, so God, don't listen for just a minute, okay? But Genesis 10 is boring, okay? As you read through that chapter, it's got all these big names that nobody on earth can pronounce except Alexander Scorby. You know, so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he begat so-and-so, and he begat so-and-so. And you're reading through this long, boring chapter of all everybody begotten everybody, and all of a sudden you come across verse 25. And it says, unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg. For in his days was the earth divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. Well, now hold on a minute. Peleg is the only guy, it doesn't say anything about anybody else. Why does it say something about Peleg? It says, in his days was the earth divided. And then it says his brother's name was Joktan. Nobody else gets their brother mentioned. Why would his brother be mentioned? Well, the word Joktan means shorten. Peleg means divided. Peleg was born about 100 years after the flood. Notice he only lived to be 239. His daddy and grandpa and great-grandpa lived into their 400s. What was different? What happened in the days of Peleg? Next thing you need to keep in mind, the pre-flood world had a canopy of water above and water under the crust of the earth. Okay? Now, I made a decision years ago as a new Christian. I was 16 when I got saved, and all the atheists in my city started coming after me, trying to get me converted, you know, away from Christianity. And I had some real problems believing some of the things in the Bible. They were showing me supposed contradictions and all that. We'll cover more on that in video 7. But I had to make a decision as a 16-year-old new Christian. I said, Lord, I'm going to believe your book until somebody can prove it's wrong. Some of my friends decided they're going to doubt the Bible until it's proven right. I think that's a mistake. I think I made the right decision. I said, God, I'm going to believe you even for the things I don't understand. And he's proven himself on just about every one of them. There's a couple I still got questions about. There was an atheist one time came to the preacher and said, Preacher, I don't believe anything in the Bible. I only believe science. He said, Preacher, if you can prove one verse out of the Bible scientifically, I'll believe it. The preacher said, well, okay. He grabbed the atheist around the neck, grabbed his nose, and began twisting his nose. Pretty soon, of course, the blood is pouring down his face, and the atheist said, what on earth are you doing? He said, I'm proving the Bible. It says the wringing of the nose bringeth forth blood. I don't recommend you do that, unless you get a really hardcore atheist, then you might want to try that one. But I'm going to give you the Hovind theory. Now, this is supposed to be good teaching technique. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to tell you what I told you. You get all that? We're going to go through it very quickly, 8 simple steps of what I think caused the flood and explain all these strange phenomena on the planet. Then we'll go into them in a little bit more detail and then we'll close this down. Noah and the animals got safely into the ark. A 300-degree below zero ice meteor came flying toward the earth and broke up in space. As it was breaking up, some of the fragments got caught and became the rings around the planets. They made the craters on the moon, the craters on some of the planets, and what was left over came down and splattered on top of the North and South Pole. The super cold snow fell on the poles mostly, burying the mammoths standing up. The dump of ice on the North and South Pole cracked the crust of the earth, releasing the fountains of the deep. The spreading ice caused the ice age effects, the glacier effects that we see. It buried the mammoths, made the earth wobble around for a few thousand years, and it made the canopy collapse that used to protect the earth, and opened up the fountains of the deep. During the first few months of the flood, the dead animals would settle out and dead plants and get buried. They would become coal if they're plants and oil if they're animals. And those are still found today in huge graveyards. Fossils found in graveyards, oil found in big pockets under the ground. During the last few months of the flood, the unstable plates of the earth would shift around. Some places lift up, other places sink down. That's going to form ocean basins and mountain ranges. And the runoff would cause incredible erosion, like Grand Canyon, in a couple of weeks. Over the next few hundred years, the ice caps would slowly melt back, retreating to their current size. The added water from the ice melt would raise the ocean level, creating what's called a continental shelf. It would also absorb carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which allows more radiation to get in, which is going to shorten people's lifespans. And in the days of Peleg, it finally took effect. The earth still today shows the effects of this devastating flood. Now, a little more detail on each one. God told Noah, Lord said to Noah, come thou. Did you catch that? Listen very carefully. What did God tell Noah to do? He told him to come into the ark. He didn't say go into the ark. He said come into the ark. Where does God have to be in order to say that? In the ark. That'll preach, brother. There's a sermon right there, just right there. Come into the ark, Noah. Come with me. We're going on a little cruise. Come on in. I'm here with you. And when the flood was over, God said to Noah, go out of the ark. God was with him the whole time. That would be quite the cruise. And the Lord shut the door. By the way, good eternal security verse. If the Lord's got you saved, you're saved, okay? You can't get out of God's hand. Then this 300-degree below-zero ice meteor came flying through the solar system. Some of it broke apart. It made craters on Mercury and craters on the Moon. 4 of the planets today still have rings around them. And the rings around these planets are made of rock and ice. Very interesting. Now, Walt Brown thinks some of the craters on the moon were formed when the fountains of the deep broke open and rocks went flying up out of Earth's gravitational pull, drifted around for a while, and clobbered into the moon. He may be right on that, I don't know. But it's interesting. He thinks the comets came from Earth, and water on Mars came from Earth when the fountains of the deep broke open. You could read about it for yourself if you'd like. The super cold snow would land mostly around the poles, because super cold ice is not only affected by the magnetic field, it's easily statically charged. How many have seen the Van de Graaff generator where they make your hair stand up? You know, we've got one of those at our science center at Dinosaur Adventureland. As this ice meteor came flying toward the Earth, it broke apart. Pieces would settle in around the poles mostly, causing the Earth to wobble for a few hundred years, or maybe even a few thousand years. The canopy of water overhead collapsed and it rained 40 days. The water underneath the bottom, under the crust, came shooting to the surface, and the water kept going up for 150 days. And everybody drowned. It probably took 6 or 8 months to kill everybody during that flood. We all get the idea, well, it rained and everybody died first day. No, it took a long time for people to die. People would be running and fighting for higher ground. As that got more and more rare, as the water keeps coming up and up and up, for 150 days, the water increased. By the way, they're still discovering chunks of ice flying around in space. Here's an article about a scientist who discovered chunks of ice as big as this auditorium are hitting the Earth all the time. They dissolve in space, but it rains down as water. There's water everywhere in space. Science and technology article here. If you go to the North Pole, you'll be kind of chilly, and one of only 400 people that have ever been there. But up around the North Pole, there's an ocean called the Arctic Ocean. I went up to see the Arctic Ocean a couple years ago, and the guy said, hey, Brother Hovind, you know something interesting about this ocean? It has no tide. I said, man, I never thought of that. Taught her science for 15 years. Arctic Ocean has no tide. And who cares, right? Anyway, but there's an island up there called the New Siberian Islands off the coast of Russia. There on those New Siberian Islands, they find frozen bobcats, frozen lynx, frozen camels. What happened? When they drill down through the ice, when they get to the South Pole and drill through the ice, they find coal under the ice at the South Pole. I would like to point out, Your Honor, there are no trees in Antarctica. Zero. Admiral Byrd went down there and said they saw frozen palm trees or palm leaves near the South Pole. Scientists have discovered all sorts of frozen leaves, even dinosaur fossils, plant-eating dinosaurs, near the South Pole. Thousands of well-preserved leaves found in Antarctica. Leaves on the side of a cliff 250 miles from the South Pole. And the leaves still retain their original cellular structure and organic content. They're not petrified. They're preserved. They find dinosaurs, plant-eating dinosaurs, in northern Alaska. There are no trees up there. I was there. Nothing. Not a blade of grass in most places. See, the Earth actually has two North Poles. We have a geographic North Pole where we spin around. We also have a magnetic North Pole in Canada where the compass actually points. Now, here in Tennessee, it probably doesn't make a lick of difference. Your compass points north because both of them pretty much line up. But if you live in Alaska, your magnetic north is way different than the real north, and pilots have to learn to adjust for that. And who cares, right? Okay. I think what happened, the mammoths were up there chomping on their tropical flowers. It was a beautiful day. And it began to snow, super cold snow. They had never seen snow before. One of the mammoths looked at his buddy and he said, Herman, this is peculiar weather we're having here. What is this white stuff falling out of the sky? I said, I don't know, but let's get out of here. They started running around trying to find a place to hide, and the snow got deeper and deeper and deeper, and they got stuck in the snow standing up, and they couldn't even fall down. How many of you have ever been in a snowdrift so deep you couldn't even fall over? You ever been in one of those? I think that's what happened to the mammoths. People say, well, the mammoths have long hair. They're designed for cold weather. No, mammoths are not designed for cold weather. A lot of animals in the jungle have long hair where it's hot, okay? If the temperature is 70 degrees, long hair is just simply a decoration. There's a lot of things about the mammoth that shows they are not designed for cold weather. There's a whole section just in this book about mammoths are not designed for cold weather. You can read all about that. So the mammoths, some of them, ended up frozen standing up in super cold ice, 300 below zero. As the ice goes pushing out toward the equator, it's going to carve out glacial grooves. If you live in Ohio, if you go out to Kelly's Island, you can go out in the Lake Erie and see the glacial grooves, scratches across the rock for miles. I think the ice age really happened, but it happened at the beginning of the flood. There are basically two theories among creationists about the ice age. One theory says the ice age caused the flood, which is what I believe. The other theory says the flood caused the ice age. A minor difference, I don't think it's worth fighting over, but either case, though, I think the flood would, or the ice age would last several hundred years after the flood. During the time after the flood, as populations are growing, if somebody misbehaves, instead of building a jail and putting them in there where you got to feed them for the rest of their life, just banish them. Say, get out of here. You can't stay with our civilization. And boy, if times were hard and just new struggling civilization like Gilligan's Island, being banished is punishment enough. Now, you're going to follow the Ice Age animals around and kill them and, leave your toolbox behind because you don't want to carry 50 pounds of rocks with you. You wait till you find the mammoth herd and you make your tools on the spot and kill the mammoth. That's why they find, scrapers for skin and all kinds of flint arrowheads and stuff are found all over the world. These guys are, they really do use these stone tools to kill these animals, but they don't carry them with them because they're so plentiful. They're found all over the arrowheads and stuff like that. Anyway, then this super cold ice at the pole would send off a cold wave, like when you open the freezer and the cold air comes out and falls at your feet. This cold air hitting warm air would cause it to rain. And it rained 40 days and 40 nights. The canopy collapsed. The Bible says all the fountains of the deep were broken up in one day. If you read the book of Jasher, you can get it from our ministry. I cannot verify that it's legitimate, the actual book of Jasher referred to in the Bible. There is a book of Jasher referred to in the Bible. This may or may not be it, I don't know. But it's interesting reading nonetheless. In the book of Jasher it says, "And on that day the Lord caused the whole earth to shake, and the sun darkened, and the foundations of the world raged, and the whole earth was moved violently, and lightning flashed, and the thunder roared, and all the foundations of the earth were broken up." Jasher chapter 6. Interesting. I think what happened, the dump of ice on the poles caused the earth's crust to crack. Ice spread out toward the equator, buried the mammoths, made the earth wobble, and the earth was totally covered by water. The Bible says all the high hills were covered. Now, there are some idiots out there teaching it was just a local flood in the days of Noah. The Bible says the high hills were covered. It's not a local flood. If the earth were reduced down to the size of this globe right here, all the oceans in the world would only fill about one tablespoon. If you smoothed out the earth, the oceans right now would be 12,000 feet deep. Oceans average 12,000 feet deep. But if you smoothed out the earth, they would average 8,000 feet deep everywhere. There's plenty of water on the earth to cover the planet. Technically, one drop of water would cover the planet if you spread it real thin. I mean, real thin. I flew back over to the Pacific one time, and I came back, I said to one of the guys in my office, I said, "Man, that Pacific Ocean is huge." He said, "That's just the top of it." Wow, what a thought. That is just the top of it. There's a lot of water in these oceans out there. When the climbers got to the top Mount Everest, 1953, the year I was born, they got up here on Mount Everest, they began to find something interesting. Petrified clams on top Mount Everest. In Peru a couple years ago, they found giant oysters up to 11 feet across, 2 miles above sea level. That's a big oyster. You should see the pearl. And these clams are interesting. I've got some on the table down here. They're petrified clams in the closed position. Now think about it for a minute. When a clam dies, it opens. The muscle inside relaxes, the ligaments on the outside pull the shell open almost instantly. When a clam dies, it opens up. How would you get bazillions of petrified clams in the closed position on top of mountains all over the world? Well, I would like to point out, Your Honor, that Mount Everest is a little ways from the beach, number one. Number two, clams do not climb mountains very well. And number three, when a clam dies, it opens. The best explanation for this is they were buried alive. Sometimes huge beds of these are found. A guy in Op, Alabama said, "Brother Hovind, you want some petrified clams for a museum?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "They're 4 feet thick in my backyard." When he rototills his garden, he brings up thousands of petrified clams, closed petrified clams. We've got a bunch in our museum down in Pensacola, Florida. Even fragile items like eggs are found fossilized. I believe the sediments would settle out of this flood Fine sediments would preserve things in incredible detail. Here's a fossilized jellyfish. We have an arm to an octopus, fossilized octopus arm in our museum. Soft tissue simply doesn't fossilize under very special conditions are required. The Bible says the fountains of the deep broke open. So I think the earth got struck by a meteor. The water underneath went shooting to the surface, and the earth was covered with water. See, the earth's crust is kind of interesting. Pretty thin, actually, in some spots. 3 to 5 miles thick under the crust, under the oceans, and 30 miles thick under the continents. The hot water from inside the earth would come shooting out, and it would kill animals that live within a certain radius of this, of the crack as the hot water escaped. As the basalt bulged up in the middle, the plates are going to slide down, explaining, as I said earlier, about the wrinkled mountains. Take a look at these mountains in British Columbia. They've been pressed from the end, wrinkled up. What happened? As the water came shooting out, the hot water would kill all sorts of things within a certain radius. If you poured a gallon of boiling water into your aquarium, it would kill all the fishies within a certain distance, okay, until the temperature was dissipated. All over the world, little tiny creatures called diatoms are found dead in great big thick beds called diatomaceous earth. These diatoms are super tiny. It takes about 1,000 years to get an inch of dead diatoms at the bottom of the ocean. They very slowly accumulate. When it dries out, they pack it into a special powder called diatomaceous earth. It is used for all sorts of things. It's used as kitty litter. It's used as oil dry. Diatomaceous earth is used as swimming pool filters, used in bricks, used in aspirin. It's used in medicines. It's used in all sorts of strange things you would never think of. It's diatomaceous earth because it is so absorbent. I was in Lompoc, California preaching, and I went to visit the world's largest diatomaceous earth quarry. I believe it's the world's largest. They're in Lompoc, California, which is right smack on top of the San Andreas Fault. There in Lompoc, California, back in 1976, they found the fossil skeleton of a whale standing on end, 80 feet long, running through diatomaceous earth. Now, I know the whale is parallel with the layers. That's okay, because the layers have tilted up also. So the thickness of the whale becomes the problem, not the length. But still, if this stuff accumulates an inch every 1,000 years, how long is a dead whale going to lay there waiting for this stuff to gather around him? Dead whales are dissolved at the bottom of the ocean in a few weeks or months. Even the bones eventually disappear. They gave me a chunk of their diatomaceous earth out there. In that one little square foot, there are dozens, maybe even up to 60, fish skeletons. You know, fish skeletons are found in diatomaceous earth, and they're found with their gills extended, their fins extended. They died terrified. Whatever was happening to them was terrifying these creatures. Fossil fish are found by the trillions. The chalk cliffs of England and Dover, England are found this way. Chalk, from the Latin word cretia, which means chalk. Chalk 300 feet thick. There was a catastrophe that formed all this. The Bible says the waters prevailed upon the earth. I think what happened during the first part of the flood, dead things settled out. And that flood represents God's judgment on this planet. Point number 5 of the Hovind theory is during the first few months of the flood, the dead animals would settle out. People ask, why aren't more human fossils found? Well, humans are smarter than animals. Some humans are, and some animals. And they would tend to avoid drowning till the last possible minute. Animals that are buried on top or very, very shallow soil are not going to fossilize. Think of all the millions of buffalo that were killed out west in the last few 100 years. None of them fossilized because they weren't buried. So fossils only form if an animal is buried pretty deeply and pretty quick before it has time to decay. Marvin Lubinow says about 4,000 sets of human remains have been found. I think there are fewer humans than animals found fossilized because they were smarter and would avoid drowning till later in the flood, and therefore they're not going to be fossilized. We cover more on that in video 7. The trees that are uprooted would float around in big log mats the size of Texas. They're going to be buried and become the coal seams that we see today. Moving water does some very interesting phenomena. As water is moving, it automatically sorts things. It can form 5 or 6 layers simultaneously. There's a good videotape called Experiments in Stratification that shows the top strata can actually be older than the bottom strata. If the water's moving, it forms multiple layers simultaneously. Moving water does some strange things. How many have ever seen those things you buy at the store with 2 pieces of glass and different colored sand in between? And when you flip it over, it forms all these layers real quickly, okay? It doesn't take a long time. Stratification can happen very quickly. Underwater landslides, like the one we saw in Indonesia in 2004, can cause, it's called a turbidity current, they can do enormous damage underwater, causing tsunamis on the surface, which kill 250,000 people. In 1929, there was an underwater landslide that traveled 70 miles an hour, cut two transatlantic cables. That one landslide covered 40,000 square miles. That's about the size of Ohio. One landslide underwater. During the flood, the water would be swirling around, and the dead animals would tend to, you know, get caught in these little swirls called eddies. This happens today. If you walk along the river, you see the river moving one direction, but along the sides, there's little eddies, swirling water. This would happen on a global scale during the flood of Noah. As the animals would float around for a few weeks, they would rot, and their head falls off, and tail falls off, and legs fall off. And when they finally get buried, you end up with tangled up messes of dinosaur bones. Notice these backbones here have no head attached, no legs, just the backbone. Underwater landslides do enormous damage, and surface animals buried on the surface under mud can be entangled up messes. Fossil graveyards are very common all over the planet. They found a concentration of fossils like logs in a log jam. If you go to San Jacinto Monument in Texas, where Santa Ana finally met his match when the Texans caught up with him, the whole monument is made out of fossils. I mean, you look at the blocks of rock, it looks like great big blocks of stone, and they are. As you get up closer, there are bazillions of little tiny fossils in them. There's four animals that are found fossilized in the swimming position, their head held up high out of the water. I believe they probably got caught in the mud as the mud settled out of the water, and they drowned or died in the swimming position. In one place in Africa called the Karoo Formation, they said there are 800,000 million skeletons of vertebrate animals. A lot of animals died at one time. They found iguanodon skeletons in a Belgian coal mine extending through 100 feet of rock in the vertical position. Up in Canada, on Axel Island, they find petrified redwood stumps. You can go to Axel Island. There are no trees on Axel Island. There are certainly no redwood trees growing there. How do we get fossilized redwood stumps on Axel Island?
Okay, and that's going to do it for the second episode of Kent Hovind's theory, his Hovind theory, as he calls it. That is part two. We are going to have a part three, which I'll try to get posted up here within a week or so. I decided to go ahead and divide these things up like this just so I don't have such really, really long podcasts that are really hard to listen to. So that's the whole point of breaking these things up. But anyway, I hope you enjoy listening to it. The rest of it's really interesting. And if you have any questions or comments, you can get in contact with us at truthseekers2012@gmail.com. You can check us out on our website at kennywilliamson.com. And also, if you want to check out the new book that came out, The Haunting of Virginia Krim, you can check that out on Amazon or on Barnes & Noble. So there's going to be kind of a sequel coming out to that one here. It's going to be a few months, maybe a little longer, but there's another one in the works already. So check those things out. Any questions, comments, if you like what you're hearing, like it, share it. And, you know, thanks for listening. I pray that it helps you, and God bless you.